Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
We are back in the House of Mystery, and we are at the interview part of the show. So joining us today, we have an author, and this book's been very interesting, and it really caught my eye because my main home is up in the Okanagan in BC, Canada, and we get a lot of fires. So the book is called Malibu Burning. It's the real story behind LA's most devastating wildfire. And the guest is the author, Robert Kerbeck. Thank you for taking the time today.
Well, thanks for having me, gentlemen.
Robert, so this is quite the book. I've been listening to it. And, you know, first of all, it's all obviously very personal to you. Did you write before this, or was this something that came out of this fire?
Sure. Well, you know, way back when I was a young man, I was an English major in college. And as much as I enjoyed writing, I wanted to meet women more, and so I went into the theater, and I became a professional actor for many years, and so I got away from the writing. But that was really kind of the art form that I started with, and some years ago, you know, I'm you know, married now and settled down, and 2 years back I started writing again, and started writing short stories and getting a lot of short stories published, and started a writers group in Malibu called the Malibu Writers Circle, where we have some pretty well-known writers that are members. And we had this, you know, horrific wildfire that, you know, roared through Los Angeles County, the worst wildfire in Los Angeles recorded history. And it started on a Thursday. And the following Monday, the New York Times, there was an email from the New York Times in my inbox, and they said, hey, you know you run this writers group, the Malibu Writers Circle. Do you happen to have any good fire stories? And, of course, they didn't know that my wife, son, and I fought the fire, the worst of the fire, to save our home. And so I told the editor that story, and he said, oh, my gosh, please write that for us. And so I started to write this essay for the New York Times, and then my wife's best friend worked at the Los Angeles Times, and she found out about it, and she was very unhappy that I was writing a story for the New York Times when I lived in the L.A. area. And she felt like the story should be for the L.A. Times. So it's probably the only time in my writing career that the two largest papers in the country were fighting for my work.
Well, that's a good thing. Now, so with the fires, it's an important work, what is it that you wanted people to get out of the book? Like when someone picks up your book and reads it and takes this home, so what do you want them to walk away with?
Sure. I love that question. You know, the first thing that was the most important thing to me is, you know, everybody here is Malibu and they think that everybody is rich and famous. And I'm here to tell you that is not the truth. And there's almost a dividing line that runs through Malibu, which is the Pacific Coast Highway. And I'm sure many of your listeners have driven up or down the Pacific Coast Highway and maybe even gone through Malibu. On the ocean side of the Pacific Coast Highway, yes, you've got some very wealthy people and some very, very famous people. But on the land side of the Pacific Coast Highway, there are actually a lot of blue-collar people, and people are surprised to find out that on the land side of the Pacific Coast Highway, there are firefighters and sheriffs and teachers and broke surfers. And so that was the first thing that was really important for me, is to dispel this notion that everybody is rich and famous in Malibu, because I think sometimes, and not a lot of people, but some people, when they heard about this fire and how terrible it was in Malibu and how we lost almost 2,000 homes and structures and people died, you know, there was some, occasionally you hear this, well, they're all rich people, they can rebuild, it's not a problem for them. And of course, the vast majority of people that lost homes were on the land side of the highway, and they were not the super wealthy people. Indeed, many of the people were older and underinsured, and many of them are having a really hard time being able to rebuild. So that was kind of the first thing that was important to me, so readers coming to this book, you know, understood the loss that the people here took.
Yeah, it's pretty devastating when you go through that. And I don't think people realize how frightening it really is when you're in the middle of something like that and the fire is burning all around you. Maybe describe some of the feelings you had and what you went through with your home during the fire.
Sure. You know, and this was my first major wildfire. We'd had a small brush fire on the hill above us a year earlier, but it was really no big deal. But this was, of course, you know, massive. And I think there were so many things about it that were frightening and amazing. But the first thing that really stuck with me was the speed at which the fire moves. And it doesn't just move, like it would be as if, let's say, you were running down a hill and you would jump and you would fly 50 feet in the air and land 100 feet further down, you know, and then you would jump again and you would go 30 feet in the air and you would land 200 feet down. I mean, it was as if the fire was being thrown at us. And that was the thing that was incredible. And then all of a sudden, you know, you'd be standing there and a fire would pop up out of nowhere. And it's because these fires in Southern California are almost always accompanied by these Santa Ana winds. It's a weather pattern where these very hot and dry winds blow from the desert to the ocean, and they pick up speed in the arroyos and canyons of Southern California, so that eventually they reach hurricane force. And as you can imagine, when you get something that catches on fire and you've got 70-mile-an-hour winds blowing that brush or whatever it is that's caught on fire, that fire spreads really, really rapidly. And that was the thing that was most striking about the Woolsey Fire.
So what do you think's going on? This seems to be a more common thing, because I don't remember these kinds of fires happening as regularly when I was a kid as they do now. And I mean, for people that don't know, that's back in the 60s and early 70s when I was a kid, so that was a long time ago. But it just seems to be so much more common now, almost every year it seems like. And they seem to be getting worse. What's your thought on that?
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. They are getting worse. When I did the research for the book, of course, I was researching, you know, fires, you know, back as far as they were recorded in California. And four of the worst 10 recorded fires have happened in the last two and a half years. So, you know, clearly the fires are getting worse. And, of course, at the same time that we had this devastating fire in Malibu, the Woolsey Fire, at the exact same time, we had the Camp Fire, which was decimating the town of Paradise. and killing nearly 100 people. So these two fires, one in Northern California, one in Southern California, were happening at the exact same time. So I think that is pretty strong evidence that these fires are getting worse. And I think there are a number of reasons. You know, obviously, you know, one of the things that we're dealing with is we're getting a hotter and drier planet. And obviously, the drier the brush, the easier it is for it to catch fire, and then, of course, the easier it is for that fire to become more extreme, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing these extreme fires. We just saw one in Australia that was just unprecedented. And we're also seeing, I think, a lot of fires related to the utility companies and equipment failure. You know, we've got these grids, which are older, you know, telephone wires and telephone poles. In Northern California, there was a failure there that started the campfire, and the same exact thing happened here in Southern California. Southern California Edison, which is the utility provider for Southern California, their equipment failed, which started the Woolsey fire. So we've got these grids which are older and aging and are not being maintained properly, and of course when you have a power line go down during a Santa Ana wind event, you know, that line snaps and then it hits a piece of brush and catches it, this dry brush catches on fire, and now you have two horrific wildfires. So I think it's a combination of factors, one of which is sort of somewhat rectifiable, which is, you know, we can get the utility providers to do a better job of maintaining their equipment. And the other one is a bigger picture, which is, what do we do as citizens of the planet Earth to, you know, reduce the, you know, the global warming issue?
With the whole global warming thing in the U.S., it tends to be very political. Do you see any way to get through to people that don't believe in that the world is getting warmer? Or is there, like, how do, because you have to get people on board in order to get this to go ahead.
Yeah, and that's a great question. You know, the U.S. is very politicized and very kind of divided. I'm shocked by it sometimes because, you know, some of the things that people are fighting about, you know, don't seem to be that big a deal. You know, with a brief segue over to our COVID-19 pandemic, you know, there's a big question about, you know, masks, and some people don't want to wear the mask and other people do want to wear the mask. And, you know, some people feel you should have to wear the mask. Sometimes it's required to wear the mask, but then other people feel it's impinging on their freedom to wear the mask. And sometimes that just surprises me because at the end of the day, you know, we're just asking you to care for your fellow citizens and be slightly inconvenienced by wearing a mask for a certain amount of time in certain places. It doesn't seem like it should be that big a deal, but for some people it really has become a big deal, and that surprises me. And in terms of the climate issue, you know, it's similar. Now, I will say, you know, when we see events like the Woolsey fire here in Malibu, I do think a lot of people go, wow, you know, that was a pretty crazy fire. You know, why the heck was that fire so insane? You know, I've lived in Southern California for 40 years, 50 years. Why was this fire so much worse? You know, why did we have the Thomas fire in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties the year before? And that was a horrific fire. You know, so I do think there is a certain logic that people are starting to see. Unfortunately, it involves, you know, people dying. It involves people losing their homes for people to kind of begin to get the memo, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. So what do you think we can do to make things better, each one of us?
Well, big picture or small picture?
Well, probably both. I mean, big picture, obviously we've got to get, you know, a government that is looking to solve this problem or looking at really doing something about our whole climate and our whole the way we treat the environment. I mean, that's just basic common sense. But us, other than that, for us in a daily small picture way.
Well, you know, the thing I talk a lot about in the book is, you know, you know, a lot of the locals called this fire the yo-yo fire, for you're on your own. You know, there was really very little help from firefighters. And indeed, there were times where the firefighters refused to fight the fire despite homeowners begging for help. And so one of the things, you know, I've talked about, you know, I did over 200 interviews for the book, and now I'm asked to speak to a lot of organizations, Rotary clubs, you know, realtors associations, homeowners associations, children, about, you know, well, what do we do as a community so that we don't have these terrible fires and our homes don't burn down? And I really talk, you know, the simplest thing and the easiest thing is you have to get to know your neighbors. Because when there's a disaster, when a disaster strikes, whether it's a fire or a tornado or a dam breaking or an earthquake, you know, really the only ones you can count on are your own family and your neighbors. And, you know, one of the, you know, I hate to use the expression silver linings when these fires are so terrible, but, you know, one of the positive things that's come out of it is, you know, I've gotten to know so many of my neighbors I didn't know before. We've done training sessions together so that we're prepared for fires in the future. We've all done a much better job of removing flammable landscaping and installing ember-resistant vents in our home. Moving wood piles away from home, you know, not using wood mulch near your home, all these little things, you know, because, you know, at the end of the day, wood mulch burns and firewood too close to your house can catch on fire and burn your house down. One ember can slip inside a vent that doesn't have an ember-resistant vent on it. And little things like that burn your home down, you know. I'd say 50% of the homes that were lost in the Woolsey Fire, it wasn't from some tremendous wall of flame. It was one ember, you know, and it landed on your backyard cushions on your deck, and those cushions caught on fire. Then they set the deck on fire. Then the deck burned and got so hot it burned the house down, right? Or one ember slipped inside the attic and landed on something that was flammable, and then the next thing you know, the house burned down. And so a lot of the homes that were lost and homes that are lost in these fires, they are preventable. Those are preventable losses if people, you know, I always say, give your home a fighting chance. And here are the things you can do that even in the worst wildfire, you're giving your home a fighting chance. And if you give your home a fighting chance and your home doesn't burn, it means it's much less likely that your neighbor's house is going to burn, which means it's much less likely that your whole neighborhood is going to burn. And when you think about the environmental cost of all of that loss, first of all, you have all of these things now going into the atmosphere, right? You know, you've got the paint in your garage is being burned, you know, your refrigerator is melting, your car is melting because these fires are 2,000 degrees. And so all of that is now into the environment. It's into the ground, it's into the air, people are breathing it in. It's a terrible environmental issue, these fires. So if we can do things to prevent that, just that alone is doing a lot to help the environment.
Yeah, it's really, another thing too is the way people behave. Like in the Okanagan area when I'm there, there's a lot of campsites, so people will leave fires burning or they throw a cigarette, you know, or something like that, and there's quite a few problems that way. What's the issue that started your fire?
The Woolsey Fire was utility, the Southern California Edison's equipment failed, which of course is terrible, but then it failed during a Santa Ana event, which is even worse. And then, of course, the location of the equipment failure was on the site of this secret nuclear meltdown at this Santa Susana Field Laboratory, where for years they did rocket tests there, and then later they experimented with nuclear power in the 50s, and they had a number of partial meltdowns and one nearly complete meltdown. And so all of the toxins from those nuclear meltdowns were in the soil. The site had never been cleaned up. It's well known how contaminated the site is. And it was basically a worst-case scenario. Like, okay, we're going to have the worst wildfire in L.A. history, and it's going to start on the site of a secret nuclear meltdown.
Well,
yeah. And to this day, a lot of people in Los Angeles still don't know that. It's really amazing. You know, Los Angeles Magazine, which is a wonderful magazine, they excerpted a chapter from the book, and the editor, managing editor, who runs Los Angeles Magazine, the biggest magazine in Los Angeles, one of the biggest magazines in the country, he didn't know about the fire starting on the site of this secret nuclear meltdown.
Yeah, it's just, it's crazy, some of the things that go on that we don't know about, and it's just, I don't know. So, now, in your book itself, like, you talk about the you know, how the fire hits and all that stuff, and you talk about hosing down your house and all that, and all of a sudden how it just jumps and all that stuff. That was pretty, it's pretty shocking. I don't think people realize that. Kind of maybe give the listeners a little rundown of what you experience when you're in that situation.
well, I'd tell you, time moves fast. Time moves fast, faster than the fire moved. I mean, it is just a whirlwind. Fortunately, my wife is one of those kind of calm, cool, and collected people that the world needs more of. Her father was actually a rocket science scientist, and so she kind of had that scientific mind and really was instrumental in helping us, because we do live in not only a wildfire prone area. Some people call Malibu the wildfire capital of North America. Now you can debate that, but we certainly get a lot of wildfires here. And when we bought our house, we have a Victorian home. So as you can imagine, a Victorian home is all wood, you know, and there are wood decks and balconies, and there's wood everywhere. And so if any home should have burned down, it should have been ours. 17 of 19 on our street burned to the ground. But the reason that our home didn't burn was, one, we had really great brush clearance, and then I'd be remiss if I said we didn't have a little luck. And maybe we'll call that the second reason. But the third reason, and I think the big thing, was that we were prepared. We had equipment to fight the fire. We had a fire pump, we had fire hoses, and we had a chemical called Phoscheck, which is the same chemical that the fire department uses. And so as the fire was approaching, we sprayed our entire house with this foam retardant. We sprayed all of our vegetation. We sprayed everything. And we strongly believe that Phoscheck prevented our home from burning and saved our house. And a lot of homeowners, you know, when I speak to homeowners events, you know, because, of course, the fire department, they want everybody to evacuate right away, understandably. They don't want people staying behind and then maybe getting into trouble, and now the fire department has to try to rescue them, and now, you know, more lives are being put at risk. So they always say, you know, as soon as you get the word about a fire, evacuate. And then there are other people, you know, kind of, you know, Malibu, again, people don't realize it, but there's a lot of people here in Malibu that are kind of still frontier types. You know, because Malibu not that long ago was the frontier, you know, less than 100 years ago. And there are a lot of people that are descendants of those people, and they are never leaving. They're staying to fight every fire. And so you've got those two extremes, people that evacuate right away, people that are staying no matter what. And I like to tell homeowners that there's a third option. And the third option is when you hear news of a fire potentially approaching, you prep your house. Now, some of the prep you have to have done in advance, you know, you're going to need to have already had your Phoscheck and your fire pump and tested it every year. But some of the other things you can do at the last minute can be very valuable to saving your house. So, you know, we talked about how a lot of times it's outdoor furniture that catches on fire, and ember lands, catches your outdoor furniture, and then your house burns down. So all of that outdoor furniture needs to be moved away from the house or moved inside the house. You know, anything that could burn has got to get moved away from the house. Your outside barbecue in the propane tank, you got to either put it in the house or move it far away from the house. And these are things that you can do at the last minute that, again, can give your house a fighting chance to survive.
Wow. It's just, I don't think it's, so how much, do you expect this to keep going on now? Do you expect more wildfires in your area?
That's the question that everybody would like to have the answer to. This past year, we had so many wildfires, so many. It was like every day there was another fire. Some days there were two fires, and we got really lucky. I think the fire department, you know, like I said earlier, the fire department, there were a lot of failures during the 2018 Woolsey fire, and I think a lot of firefighters and citizens were quite disappointed with the fire department in 2018, but I think they learned some lessons from that, and one of the lessons they learned was the importance of getting aerial assets on fires right away, because once these fires get a chance to spread out with these winds, they're almost unstoppable. And I think a lot of people would say they are unstoppable. And so it's really important that they get these aerial assets dropping water or this FOSCHECK on these fires right away. And in 2019, they were very successful with that, and they prevented a number of fires, none of which were small fires, but they prevented them from becoming.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Major fires. One brief anecdote, I was doing a radio interview back in November, and this was a live radio show. So I'm on live radio and my phone is blowing up and I see it's my mother calling, and I have an elderly mom. And you know, she called once, she called twice. And all of a sudden I said, you know, boy, I better answer this. And sure enough, she was being evacuated from it was called the Easy Fire, which was about to burn down the Reagan National Library in Simi Valley. So here I am on a radio show, live radio show about my book about the Woolsey Fire. And my mother's calling me being evacuated from this Easy Fire, right? So it just shows you how prevalent these fires are right now. Now, one thing that California and Governor Newsom has implemented is these power shutoff protocols. And what they are designed to do is that when strong winds are anticipated, whether it's Southern California, Central California, or Northern California, when these winds, strong winds, are predicted, the power is shut off. They literally shut off the power so that, you know, if the wind causes this equipment, the, you know, utility equipment to fail, or the equipment was going to fail anyway, but now, you know, the power line gets snapped in the wind and it starts a fire. So So they've shut off the power. Now, that's, you know, a pretty good idea in terms of stopping fires. But now you've got this other issue is when the power is shut off, not only do you not have power in your home, if you're somebody that needs power to maybe for some medical reason to power your equipment, now you're in trouble that way. Also, the traffic lights, you know, they kind of, I don't know why they didn't anticipate it, but, you know, now traffic lights were out. And I remember driving on the Pacific Coast Highway during one of these power shutoffs, and, you know, people were flying through, you know, because the traffic lights are out, people are flying through them, and other people are flying in different directions, and you could easily see how, you know, people, there could be some horrific accident. So here you shut off power to potentially stop your equipment from failing and starting a wildfire, and now people are killed in a car accident because of that. So I think Governor Newsom has recognized that that's a pretty inelegant solution, and it's a temporary solution at best. And I think the real number one most pressing issue is for the utility providers to get their equipment so that it is secure and safe and not failing and starting and being the cause of these wildfires. And I think technology is going to play a really big part of that, because one of the things now they're talking about is microgrids, where rather than them having to shut down an entire giant grid, maybe they can only shut down part of these grids, and maybe if there's an equipment failure on one part of the grid, it's not going to affect another part of the grid, and that might be a way that, you know, they're not having to shut off power for, you know, 50,000, 100,000, 250,000, 2 million, 5 million, you know, these huge numbers of folks.
Well, but the president said just rake the forest.
Yes, he did, he did. And, you know, and as you know, in Vancouver and, you know, British Columbia, I'm assuming you do call it the forest, right?
Yeah.
Here in Southern California, we don't call it the forest. We call it brush. Right, because as you know, the plant life is very different here from even Northern California, which is more forest-like. So in Southern California, you're not going to get very far trying to rake the brush.
Yeah, I know. It's just it's crazy.
And what's also crazy about that quote from President Trump is. And I really try to be fair to everybody in my book, because I feel like, you know, there were a lot of people that were at fault. And one of the things, the land that burned in the Woolsey Fire, 25% of it was federal land. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, my father always taught me, you know, keep your side of the street clean first before you start talking to your neighbor about cleaning up their side. So 25% of the acreage that burned in the Woolsey Fire was federal land, which had not been raked or cleared of brush. And I think, you know, if the president wants to get the federal lands cleared of brush, that's a great idea, you know, and then the state needs to do the same. Because, you know, it's the proliferation of overgrown brush that gets drier and drier in this hotter and hotter climate. And they've done studies that show that the longer, I mean, obviously the larger brush gets, right, there's just more fuel, but also the longer it grows without burning, when it does burn, there's much greater heat generated. And so that's another reason why, you know, clearing brush on a regular basis is important, so that the brush is theoretically somewhat, you know, not as, the fire is not going to be as intense from that brush. But, you know, it's a challenge, because, you know, there are a lot of environmentalists, and I consider myself an environmentalist, but, you know, there are different levels of environmentalists. Some are more moderate, some are more extreme. And I think a little bit more on the extreme side, there are some people that don't want any of that brush removed, and their theory is that's the natural environment and that should stay the way it is. And some of those same individuals don't believe anybody should be living in these wildfire zones. And I've heard that not often, but occasionally. And I understand that, but unfortunately, you know, those homes have been built. You know, it's kind of like, what's the expression? The cat's already out of the bag. You're not going to remove thousands and thousands of homes from these areas, and also as a country, you know, and I'm talking about the United States now, but I'm sure it's the same in Canada too. I'm sure if you, you know, if we could all draw up a map of places where it's probably not a good idea for people to live here because it's, you know, there's a pretty good amount of danger. You know, there'd be plenty of places we'd be moving people away from, right? We've got hurricanes in Florida. We've got tornadoes in Tornado Alley. We've got, New Orleans where, you know, we can have the levees break and fail. You know, there are a lot of places that theoretically, you know, you could make an argument that human beings shouldn't be living, and one of those is the coastal communities of California. But people are there, and so we have to deal with that reality. And I think having some sort of brush clearance is necessary.
So yeah. What do you think communities can do to better educate their residents as far as what they can do to help prevent their home from burning down in a wildfire?
I think that's the number one thing. You know, I think that's the number one thing because at the end of the day, you know, I can try to write letters to Governor Newsom, and he did write me back, and he bought my book and read my book and sent me a nice note, which is wonderful. And there have been a lot of other politicians that have read it too, which is great, and I think that that's going to be helpful because there's another book out right now called Paradise on Fire about the campfire, and I think it's a very good book, and I think it's a very important book, but it wasn't written by people that lived through the fire. And I hope that's something that gives my book a little something makes it a little bit unique because you're seeing somebody that went through it and then went and interviewed all these people people that lost everything were willing to open up to me because they knew I lived here and that I had been through and fought the same fire as they had, so they trusted me. And I think that's the number one thing is that homeowners, like I said, you get to know your neighbors, you talk about equipment that your neighbors have, that you have, you know, you get together, you test the equipment together. You know, I've had a number of neighbors come over to my home. I lay out all my equipment on my ping pong table, and we look at it. They take pictures of it. They email me questions. Should I order this? Should I get that? And I wish more neighbors were doing it. I mean, it's not a ton of neighbors, but, you know, it only takes a few neighbors to stay and save their home and prevent a lot of homes from burning down because, as I said, you know, if my home catches and you're next door to me, highly likely your home is going to catch. And then we get this domino effect of homes burning. So if I could stop my home from burning and you could stop your home from burning, we might save an entire neighborhood. One of my favorite chapters in the book is this actor, Kevin Dillon. You probably know Kevin. He was the star of this very funny HBO show called Entourage. And Kevin's brother, Matt Dillon, is also quite a well-known actor. And Kevin stayed behind in his neighborhood, and he and just two other neighbors, they basically drew a line in the sand of their houses on their street, and all these homes around them burned. But where they kind of stood their ground and fought the fire, not one house below them burned. They stopped the fire. That's an example when homeowners are prepared. You know, they had fire pumps, they had fire equipment, that they were able to really do some great work, not only saving their homes, but saving their neighbors' homes as well.
I was going to say, so what about the COVID-19 now and all these things where people are isolated and you can't get across the border and all that? Because quite often when these fires happen, too, we're stuck with our own firefighters, but we have others from other countries like the U.S. and quite a few of the Canadian firefighters go down for, like, the Malibu fire and stuff. Is this going to make this really difficult to get through these sort of events again?
Well, I think so. And even before COVID-19, you know, one of the things that happened in the Woolsey fire, the Malibu fire, of course, was that at the same time we had this horrific fire up in Paradise. So we had these two horrific fires at the exact same time. So as you can imagine, resources were spread incredibly thin. Then on top of that, you had, because these fires were so huge, they were spreading so rapidly, the winds were so strong, you had a lot of fire departments up and down the coast afraid to send all of their engines out in case the fire got to where they were, right? And so one of the things, you know, they call it this mutual aid, and when fire departments put out this mutual aid call, you know, all of the other fire departments, you know, kind of, you know, put down what they're doing and they go to Malibu or they go to Paradise and they assist. And of course, in many cases, they did do that. But there were also a lot more resources that stayed behind because fire departments were concerned about what happens if that fire comes here. And so the resources were spread very thin. And I think that's something that we're going to see more and more of in the future, which means that fire departments are going to be working, I think, with less resources. And then you add COVID-19 to it as well, and then there's going to be a question of, well, you know, now I think if you've got your own fire department, you know, and those guys are traveling down together, theoretically they've been living in the same firehouse together. So, you know, theoretically I think it would be safe as long as they're fighting, you know, they're like, it's like they're fighting it as one unit. They're not kind of combining with other units. I think that would be okay. And of course, when you're fighting a fire, you're outside for the most part. You know, usually when a house catches fire in a wildfire, very rarely do firefighters go inside the building. The only time they would go inside the building would be if they had to rescue people. You know, once a house catches, it's usually too late. So I think that it would be okay, but it's an unknown. It really is an unknown.
Did you have a loss of life in the Malibu fire?
Yes, we lost a number of people. Mm-hmm. Two of the husband, a man. Whose wife was very kind and allowed me to interview her, despite losing her husband of over 30 years and her mother-in-law. And her husband had basically tried to rescue his mother and get her out, and they were burned alive in their car. There was another doctor who was burned in his home and died. And then there were a number of people that died right after the fire, some of whom were considered fatalities of the fire, but most were not considered fatalities from the fire. I consider them to be fatalities from the fire because, as we discussed earlier, there were a lot of people that were breathing incredibly toxic air, and a number of the people that passed after the fire were older people. And I think it's pretty obvious that they were, they were compromised by what they, took in. I can't tell you how many people told me their animals died after the fire. Neighbor had a donkey. The donkey was pregnant. The baby donkey was born stillborn after the fire. So there were a lot of examples of, you know, human beings and animals being really impacted by the toxic soot and ash that really that occurred not just during the fire, but for days and days and weeks afterwards. Because you remember when these homes burned, they just sat there for quite a long time before the debris was removed, which was done by, you know, hazmat teams that came in, you know, completely covered head to toe with protective equipment. Because again, you know, there's every terrible, horrible, chemical in now this, burned debris. And so anytime the winds would pick up weeks after the fire, all of this black soot and ash would be at your doorstep, on your windowsill. It was really incredible. The schools in Malibu Park, we have an elementary school, middle school, and high school all on the same campus. And in that on that campus, that was the neighborhood that was the most devastated by the fire. So these kids now were going to school, and my son would come back and he would talk about, you know, how every building had this, you know, black soot and ash everywhere. And so these children were walking in it, they were touching it, they were playing in it, and they were breathing it.
It's quite a process. I don't know if people realize what you have to go through when you've been in that fire, because even a lot of people that didn't lose their home still couldn't go home for quite a while.
Yeah, and you know, we, you know, I'm living in, I call it the wasteland of Malibu Park. And if you, you know, you, your listeners are going, oh boy, Malibu, boy, what a beautiful place. Oh, incredible. I'm telling you, if you came to my street right now, you would not say that. Now, you might look out at the ocean and go, oh, well, that's beautiful. But boy, this guy's neighborhood is a disaster zone, which is what it is. We are a year and a half after the fire, and of all the homes that burned, only two have been rebuilt. Only two homes in a year and a half have been rebuilt.
Wow.
And so I try to tell people, and I try to tell my neighbors, you know, every once in a while we still have some neighbors that have all of this flammable landscaping, these eucalyptus trees and pine trees and palm trees, which are so flammable and really spread. You know, these trees catch, and then they are like Roman candles, and then, you know, superheated embers go flying, and again with these winds, these embers can travel. The deputy chief of the fire department told me an ember from a eucalyptus can fly 25 miles.
Just crazy.
So, yeah, so, so, you know, that's just something I try to remind people is, you know, you do not, you know, people go, oh, well, you have insurance. You do not want your home to burn down. Not only are you going to lose everything you ever had, every heirloom, you know, every piece of your kid's artwork, you know, anything and everything is gone. You know, these fires, when they burn, the only thing that remains is the chimney. And then you're going to have a really long, difficult, and stressful process to rebuild. So that's where the fire prevention and some of the things I talked about earlier are really important. Make sure your home has those ember-resistant vents, don't have that flammable landscaping, don't have things right up against your house that can burn, no wood products. You know, all of those things can make a huge difference and save you and your neighbors a lot of pain and agony.
Yeah, 15 years ago, my mother's home burned down, and she was most upset about the baby pictures. That was the biggest thing to her. It, all the rest of it, she said, could be damned, but those baby pictures were gone forever.
Yeah, and you know, those are things you cannot get back. You know, sometimes people say, well, it's just stuff. It's just stuff, and I'm here to tell you it's not just stuff, you know. There was one gentleman whose home burned down. He was a filmmaker and a marine biologist, and he combined his two careers, and he did all of these films in the ocean, right, documentaries. And when his house burned, he lost all of that footage, and he was devastated. It was basically his life's work. He lost it all. I think the idea that, oh, it's just stuff and you can rebuild and you have insurance, I'm telling you that is as far from the truth as it could possibly be.
Yeah, you can never recover totally like that. It's pretty all your clothes, everything burns, right? Everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, vehicles, the still vehicles around here, the shells, all that remains is the shell. The tires burned. I mean, everything burns. And every once in a while you'll go to a home and you'll find, one thing that survived. You know, one of the stories in the book was this family that lived up the street from me. They lost everything that they had. And what a lot of people did is they came back to their homes hoping and praying and searching for anything that survived. And the Red Cross left out sifters. So, you know, like the old, you know, miners, the gold miners in the 1800s, you know, and you would take your sifter into the river and you'd put some dirt in it and shake it to see if, you know, after everything went away, there was a little speck of gold. Well, people here in Malibu were using these same sifters to go through the remains of their house looking for anything that might have survived. And in this one story in the book, the only thing they found was that the grandmother who lived in it was a multi-generational home, and the grandmother that lived in the home, she'd had a bank that had been given to her by her grandmother, and it was a cast iron bank, and it had also survived the 1906 San Francisco earthquake fire, and that was the only thing that survived, that cast iron piggy bank.
So now, do you have a website or anything like that, or is there a place you suggest people go?
Sure. Well, my website is just my name. It's robertkerbeck.com. So Robert, RobertKerbeck.com, RobertKerbeck.com, and you can go to my website, and from my website, you know, there's a button that takes you to places where you can buy my book. There's also information about the book, and I've been really honored that the book has won two book awards. It won the Silver Medal for Creative Nonfiction from the Independent Publishers Award, which is a really prestigious award, and it also won Best Historical Nonfiction from Best of L.A., and it's currently under consideration for Book of the Year by Forward Reviews. You know, I've just been really, you know, just blessed that the Malibu community has rallied around it. I've had all these wonderful celebrities come out to my events, and you can see their pictures on my website. Pierce Brosnan, James Bond came to in a book event and signed a book, or I signed the book for him, and he took a picture with a guy, you know, we took pictures together. Sam Elliott from The Big Lebowski came, Priscilla Presley came, activist Aaron Brockovich came, Mayor Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, Martin Sheen sent me two handwritten notes and actually offered to do an event where he was going to read a chapter from the book. Unfortunately, the event got canceled because of COVID-19, but it was really incredibly generous of him. You know, celebrities have done a lot of posting on social media about the book, which has been, you know, amazing. And you can see a lot of that stuff on my website. And there's also a really amazing video of my wife fighting the fire, right as it kind of hit us, which I think kind of shows how intense it was.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, this has been very interesting. The work is very important, and people need to realize what kind of threat we have going on here. So, again, our guest has been Robert Kerbeck, and thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you giving me the time because, like you said, this is really important.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.